Welcome to Wild Connection, the podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jennifer Vertelin. I'm a scientist and author that studies animal behavior. I'm passionate about animals and exploring the complexity of their lives, their intelligence, relationships, families, social connections, and emotions. I also love helping people reconnect with nature to live better lives. This podcast is about you, other animals, and how we're all connected in this wild and crazy thing called life. I know I'm not alone in my fascination of octopuses. They seem a little bit out of this world, and they have so many unusual traits, like the ability to edit their RNA, especially their messenger RNA. A lot of us know about messenger RNA because of COVID vaccines, but in a nutshell, these messenger molecules carry a copy of genetic instructions from DNA to other parts of the cell where proteins are made. It's not just octopuses that can do this, but lots of cephalopods can do it too. Still, octopuses stand out, at least for me. And it looks like the reason octopuses do this, at least for the two-spotted octopus, is to adapt to cold water. Researchers tested this hypothesis by slowly shifting the temperature in the tank up or down, and they went down as low as 55 degrees Fahrenheit, or 13 degrees Celsius. The octopuses in the colder tank made over 13,000 edits to their RNA that led to changes in proteins. And that's just one of the remarkable things about octopuses. I won't give everything away because my guest today is ecologist and author David Scheel. And we're going to talk about his new book, Many Things Under a Rock: The Mystery of Octopuses. Before we get started, though, if you're enjoying the podcast, please give it a like or a review and share it with your friends. Also, don't forget to check out the show notes on Wild Connection, the podcast, hosted by Podbean. Here you can find links and photos about this week's show. Okay, let's get to it. All right, everybody, welcome back to the podcast. As you know, we are continuing now to our regular programming. And this week, I am very excited to have on the show author and scientist David Scheel. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me on Wild Connections.
Thank you for being here. And, you know, we are going to talk about your book, Many Things Under a Rock: The Mystery of Octopuses. But before we do, you and I have an unusual shared connection that we kind of discovered. Who was your thesis advisor?
My thesis advisor at University of Minnesota was Craig Packer. And Craig is well known for working on African lions in the Serengeti. And he's also an author, has written a couple of books. And it's lovely to see in Craig's eyes how I show up in his little books. In one of them, I turn green with air sickness. And the other one, my name gets a mention because he wanted to talk about something that we did together, but whew, goes right by. It's brilliant.
Well, you know, I'm green with envy that you got to work with him, not to disparage my own thesis advisor, in case you're listening, Charlie. But I had dreamt of studying predators or primates. Those were my two, you know, goals. And I met Craig when I was a graduate student, a master's student, and practically, you know, shamelessly begged him to take me as a student. And he politely refused. Now, when you were working with him, you were studying lions, yes?
Yeah, working with Craig was great. And, you know, it gave me a fantastic start in the aspects of, you know, what do you got to do to be a scientist? And I, if it's any consolation, I only got on the team because another graduate student who had done her homework and connected with him and, you know, impressed him, she bombed out somehow. And so he suddenly had a gap. And I had been pestering him, much as you did, I think. And this was some years earlier. And I had been pestering him, and I was at University of Minnesota. with no expectation of what I was going to do or being able to get on with him or anything. And he suddenly said, would you be interested? And I said, of course, because just like you, I had wanted to study predators or whales. That had been my big choice, predators or whales. And I worked with him in Serengeti for a few years in the 80s wrote some papers about African lions and how they cooperate and how they forage. And it was a wonderful way to get started in the business.
Yeah, well, and I have read some of your papers, not just on lions, but then on octopuses. And how, you know, I've just got to ask, how does one go from, I mean, other than the connection of predator, which we'll talk about in a little bit, how does one go from the Serengeti lions to an octopus?
10 years of searching for a job will do that to a person.
I laugh because only a fellow, you know, scientist researcher knows what you mean.
I moved from a postdoc on global climate change, weirdly enough, which Craig was also instrumental in helping me get, because he told me one day as I was getting near my last semester as a graduate student at University of Minnesota, Craig Packer said to me, take a class in GIS. You need a skill.
Right, because getting a PhD is not a skill in and of itself.
No. And you know what? It stung a little bit, but he wasn't wrong. I took a class in GIS. It got me my postdoc in global climate change. That got me a job in Cordova, Alaska, with the Prince William Sound to do there. I'm a little slow on the uptake sometimes. And it gradually dawned on me that I had taken a one-year soft money position. And the way to keep going was to submit proposals and get my own research fund. After the first year, that led me to try a bunch of different approaches. You know, what can a classically trained behavioral ecologist with experience in Tanzania do in a coastal fishing village on the edge of the Exxon Valdez oil spill? So I ended up getting about 5 different projects going. And, you know, weirdly enough, the octopus project turned out to be the one with legs that just kept going. I'm sorry. I had to do it. The puns
are going to come from all over. I have a feeling, because there's a few that came up for me when I was reading your marvelous book, which is Many Things Under a Rock, The Mystery of Octopuses. And, you know, I feel a gravitational pull towards octopuses, and I know many people do. I'm wondering if you just got sucked into it to keep working on them because of the mystery and the magic about them.
We're all suckers for octopuses, right? So yeah, of course I did. You know, I first got intrigued by octopuses when I read The Soft Intelligence by Jacques Cousteau back when I was 10 years old or something like that. So, I come up to Cordova. It's 5 years after the oil spill, and everyone is very worried about the state of the sound. How is Prince William Sound? Is there recovery going on? What's happening? And, you know, a lot of the communities around the sound are Alaska Native communities. And the Alaska Native, the nearest big grocery store is hundreds of miles away. And so most of their food is obtained by foraging. And when you live on the ocean, you forage on the ocean. And so these guys are fishermen. They are gleaners, as they say in Africa, in Madagascar, they call this gleaning. But in Alaska, they call it subsistence harvest. And that covers everything from, plucking seabird eggs to fishing to hunting to picking food up in the intertidal. And one of the big food items in the intertidal is the octopus. The species up here is the giant Pacific octopus. It's the largest octopus species in the world. And so it's a big packet of protein, and it's a significant portion of what you can get on a day foraging along the beach.
Yeah. And, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about how those coastal communities and their relationship with octopuses not only informed sort of your book and your research, but taught you how to find them. But before that, you know, one of the things that struck me as unusual when it comes to people with our training is, and I really appreciated it in your book, early on, you write about the curiosity that octopuses sort of elicited from you. And this came with a series of questions. And you asked yourself if one question that really stuck with me was you asked if an octopus could feel embarrassed. You know, I'm wondering, do you think it's something special about octopuses? Or have you always wondered if other animals had these sort of experiences that we can all relate to, like being embarrassed?
Yeah. So let me tell you a story about an animal we're all, maybe many people are more familiar with. When I was a kid, my dad raised Irish setters, and we had a dog in the house. I think it was Misty was her name. And, you know, she was a young pup, a year old. You know, she'd been trained, she was housebroken, all of that. And I get up one morning and I'm the first one up in the house. And, you know, where's the dog? Everything's really quiet. And the dog is nowhere to be seen. And as I'm wandering around the house, I discover in one room, sort of the family room of the house, we had one of those beanbag chairs. And it's a plastic sack that you sit in, and it's big, and it's full of little tiny styrofoam beads, which are scattered across the entire room, like an inch deep. And the ripped open bag with, you know, dog bite marks right on it is cast there in front of the door. And I'm like, oh no. And I go and I finally did find the dog, and I kind of drag her into the room, and she does not want to come into the room. She did not want to be found. And she sat there, hung her head in shame, and whined at me. And I have this photo still this day of this humiliated puppy dog who just was so embarrassed, not because I yelled at her, but because she knew what she had done and she was ashamed.
Right.
And so, yeah, that was the first time I thought, is a dog smart enough to be embarrassed? This is obviously embarrassment. I'm not misreading this.
Right.
You know, and I was 15 at the time.
Sure. Right?
And so when I was writing, one of the things I wanted to do in Many Things Under a Rock is show how science works for me. And I teach science, right? And so you get the students who come in, and the scientific method is you make a hypothesis, use your hypothesis to make predictions, you test the hypothesis, and then you either accept or reject the hypothesis with a statistical level of probability. But we all know in the field, that's how you finish the scientific process part, but it's not how we do science. Science comes from having curiosity. It comes from exploring the world. It comes from having questions and going, how the heck can I even begin to answer that question?
Right.
And so in Many Things Under a Rock, I really wanted to write about how my science had unfolded.
Yeah.
You know? And so I started the book with those encounters with octopuses and just kind of the kinds of questions that they came up, which were really crazy questions like, can an octopus feel embarrassed?
Right.
And so, you know, then the rest of the book really tries to give you all the building block from the questions to the techniques to whether the techniques actually allow you to answer the question or whether they answer related but different questions.
Yeah. Well, and that's part of the flexibility that we need as scientists and researchers. But speaking of technique, you know, I was really intrigued by how you described you go about locating an octopus, and you had some help in some cases. And so I'd love for you to describe a little bit about how you learned how to find octopuses and how that changed whether you were close to shore or deep in the water.
Yeah. In Cordova, it's very much a fishing town. It's a bush town on the coast, and the harbor is the salty heart of the town, right? And everyone knew octopuses, but they knew them from fishing. And so I would ask questions when I was, you know, trying to get ready to do this. I'd ask questions like, well, where do you find octopuses? Oh, you don't find them. Well, where do you catch them? Anywhere. And so they were sort of everywhere and nowhere. And, you know, you realize eventually the fishermen are targeting fish. They want the commercial harvest because they have to make a living, just like all of us. They weren't collecting data. You know, as a scientist, you want data. As a fisherman, you want fish. That's how it goes. And so what actually finally helped me is I was interested in the octopuses because the subsistence lifestyle in the coastal villages had been damaged by the oil spill. People were not sure the food was safe to eat, and they weren't weren't sure it was going to be there in future subsequent generations. And so one of the questions that I went out to ask was, what was the effect of the oil spill on octopuses specifically? And that was a question I couldn't answer because there was not enough previous, there wasn't any previous data about octopuses in Prince William Sound to compare to. But it meant that I was working with the Alaska Native elders in the communities to ask them, how do you forage for octopuses and where do you find them? And so early on in the study, I went out to these intertidal habitats during the low tides of the year. And we walked along the beaches, you know, to put it in a phrase, we looked under rocks. And that's where we found octopuses. I eventually came to think of it as tracking because we learned to look for little tiny crabs or clam shells, which are everywhere on the beach. But there's something particular about the way they accumulate. That's the food that an octopus eats. And here in Alaska, they bring it back to the den and they separate the food from the shell. And the shells go out the door. And so we were able to find the octopuses by looking for these piles of their prey remains and then, you know, knocking on their front doors, basically.
Well, and how does an octopus feel when you knock on its front door?
They're curious.
Do they answer the door and go, hi?
Sometimes the Alaska Native method is to cut a flexible alder stick that doubles for me as both a walking stick across the rough terrain, but then it tapers to a slender tip at the other end, and you can slide that into the hole of the octopus den, which is not a big open hole. It's often very small. And the octopus, when something slides into the den like that, it grabs a hold of it. And so if you poke and there's no octopus, you're just going to feel gravel or rock. But if you poke and there's something soft, then you wait a second and it gives the octopus a moment to grab a hold. And so then you pull back. And there's nothing in the dens that other than an octopus that will hold on to that stick or try and pull it away from you. And I have had them pull, you know, a 6-foot long alder branch all the way into their den and then shove it back out again in certain long, deep dens. One time I did this little investigation, and you learn to be fairly gentle with it because you don't want to give the octopus a hard jab. You learn to be fairly gentle with it. One time I was questing after an octopus to bring back to the aquarium, and I slid the probe into the den, and this octopus just like leapt out of the den into my arm. She was so alarmed by this. So we named her Calamity. Like Calamity Jane, and we brought her back, and the students took care of her for a while till she got big and moved on. What do we do with Calamity? I think we eventually released Calamity.
Okay, wait a second. So what does it feel like for you to have an octopus leap into your arms?
It's great. It's so much easier than having to chase them down.
No, I mean, they're grabbing onto you with eight arms, I imagine, and you've got two. So
yes. It was a really big concern to me when I first was starting to do this work. I had certified as a scuba diver earlier when I was in Minnesota with another student in the same lab group, and he was going to the Caribbean to do research on wrasse and spend his time diving. And I was just back from Serengeti, and I didn't like scuba diving. So I had certified and then stopped. So when I got to Cordova and I was going to work on octopuses, I had to learn all over again. And this was in the context of getting in the water to capture the giant Pacific octopus, which can get easily over 100 pounds. And so I began to worry, how big could these animals get? And how the heck was I going to ask divers to go down and capture them in the water without injuring them so that we could bring them up and weigh them and all of that sort of stuff? So yeah, there was a lot of concern very early on about how to work with them underwater, because as you say, they have eight arms, we have two, we're not going to win.
No. And so I don't want to give away a lot of the sort of stories and myths, and we're going to talk about those also a little bit, but one of the things that struck me is here, you know, you've worked with lions, they're on terra firma, you've got trackers on them. So, and you're not trying to wrestle a lion down to put a collar on it.
No.
And you did talk about how you started then trying to track octopuses to see kind of where they go, what they eat, what they're doing, what they're up to. How on earth do you track one when they can move so fast? And do you think you've ever been sort of teased by an octopus? It knew you were following it and it kind of played a little game with you. Or was it really just, how did you even keep up?
There's a lot of questions there.
Yes.
In one little interviewer comment. Yeah. Yeah. I used to work with African lions, and I also helped a tiny bit with, you know, the wild dogs. And I had been thinking about wolves and bears as animals I would study next. And when you want to track any of those animals, they're mammals, they have necks, you put a radio collar on them, and then you can track them over the same distances that the radio will transmit using an antenna that you hold in the air. So, you know, I arrive in Cordova, new to the ocean, new to scuba diving, new to octopuses. And I, you know, oh yeah, let's track octopuses. Well, guess what? A radio does not transmit through salt water. Just doesn't, right? So you have to move to sonic tags. But octopuses are not vertebrates. They don't have necks. They don't have hard parts. So how do you even attach a transmitter to an octopus? And so this also became a major area of research, is just to figure out what could we do and how would we do it? So, you know, naturally, I asked the fisheries scientists who work on finfish. And they said, well, you know, this isn't an active tag. It's a passive tag, but you can put spaghetti tags through the fin of a fish, which is just a little flexible plastic tag that has a number on it. And so you capture the fish, you put the spaghetti tag on, you let it go. And when you recapture it, you can read the number and you know where you last headed. It's like banding a bird. Yeah. And so I thought, oh, this is great. Well, I could band an octopus. And so I put a spaghetti tag through the flesh of an octopus, a bit like a piercing, you know, just a couple of these. And of course, you knot them on a fish, you tie them in a knot. Well, the octopus just untie the knot or bite through the tag. And so, you know, we put a few of these out and quickly realized, no, useless. Got to find another way. I forget, where did you end that question with? You started
You know, it was just sort of how you go about tracking and how much harder it is, you know, because aside from the lions, you know, I study prairie dogs, which they just wake up where you left them unless they all die.
Isn't that convenient?
I know. You don't have to run around trying to find them. And then kind of the same with mountain gorillas. They don't move. They do move a lot when they are looking for fruit. But in general, you can follow them on a day-to-day basis because there's a lot of eating, sleeping, farting, and very little moving over the course of the day. And so I was just trying to think in such a three-dimensional, you know, sort of space.
Yeah.
The challenges with observing behavior, which you have done an incredible amount with octopuses, and how hard that is. And I think people, you know, if they read your book or even if they were to read some of your papers, I think people don't necessarily appreciate how much creativity and effort goes into trying to even think about answering some of these questions.
Yeah. I remember now you asked me whether the octopuses were watching us, right? And then also your question here of how do you go about observing the octopus behavior that I've recorded? And, you know, maybe there we should talk about Octopolis a little bit in Australia. But before we do, you mentioned prairie dogs. And and I just wondered, are you familiar with Jane Waterman?
Oh, that name sounds very familiar.
She's published on prairie dog.
Okay, yes.
And the reason I bring it up is she had the office next to mine when we were graduate students, and she drew a few ridiculous lion cartoons for me that really got me hooked on the notion of illustrating your science with sketches, behaviors, humor, drawings, and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, when the publisher of Many Things Under Rock, Norton Publishers, came to me and said, well, what about photos? Do you want to put photos in the book? I was like, it's going to be hard to find photographs of all the different behaviors that are told in the stories of the book, because I didn't always capture the moment on film.
Sure.
And they said, what about drawings? And I said, yes, let's do drawings. And so my daughter, Laurel, is the artist for the book and did these amazing, she grew up with octopuses and she really has a nice sense of pose and posture and tension and, you know, all of that in what really at its heart is a very different form of movement than we see on land and amongst vertebrates. And so the Many Things Under a Rock has these wonderful illustrations by Laurel, my daughter. And she also was able to work with octopuses with me for the film that PBS did, Octopus Making Contact, which we've mentioned earlier. So in terms of watching all this animal behavior, it's a challenge. And in Many Things Under a Rock, I tried to capture some of that. The first part of the book, it has some section headers. And one of the headers at the beginning is missing octopuses. And it sort of means the octopuses are missing because of the oil spill,
yeah,
right? But it also kind of means means I'm missing the octopuses because I don't know how to find them.
Yes.
And it also means everyone's missing the octopuses because they hide so darn well.
Yeah.
By the end of the book, we're seeing octopuses. There's octopuses everywhere. And part of the reason that that happened was I was able to work with Peter Godfrey Smith and Matt Lawrence in a site that they discovered, that Matt Lawrence discovered actually, south of Sydney in Australia, that we've nicknamed Octopolis. Well, Peter did, I think. It's before I joined the work. But at Octopolis, we have a situation that's a little bit unique and sort of forced a number of octopuses to den very close to one another. Basically, there's lots of food there and very little denning habitat. And because they den so close to each other, they interact constantly. But also, it means we can drop down, put a camera down, and swim away and just let the camera record. And there's the behavior is confined in space enough. We can see stuff that's never been observed with octopuses before, primarily watching them interact over and over and over again.
Right. Well, and I want to talk about some of those interactions. You know, I'm fascinated by some of the behaviors that you've studied and discovered. And I remember, I don't know where I read it, but I read about or I heard about an octopus that was in an aquarium that didn't like a particular caretaker at that aquarium. And anytime that individual would walk by, it would spit water out at it. And, you know, when it comes to octopuses that might normally be more solitary in nature, and now you have this situation where there's tons of interaction, what does an octopus argument look like?
Octopuses are really well known for this squirting behavior. And you hear about it whenever you keep them in captivity, but you also see it very often in little YouTube clips of octopuses or whatever. Anytime you watch an octopus, if there are fish swimming around, and the fish will often come and investigate what is the octopus doing, or they'll nip at its arm tips or whatever. And the octopus will be annoyed by this. And you can see them direct their exhalant siphon, their funnel, at the fish and blow a stream of water at the fish. And it just like discourages the fish. It's like trying to brush a fly away. You don't actually hit the fly in some way. More often than not, when you brush a bug away, you don't actually hit it. You're just trying to clear the space by your eyes, you know? And that's what the octopus is doing when it blows water at a fish. It's just like, get away. When you keep them in captivity, they're in shallow water, and you would think they might blow the jet at the glass in a direct line between them and your eyes, right? Like hit the glass with that water jet. And maybe the octopuses do, but of course, does that have any effect on you? Absolutely not. And so they quickly understand that if they jet out of the water towards you, then you're going to get a face full.
Yes.
And the water that I work with is 10 degrees centigrade, which is 40-ish Fahrenheit. So it's cold water. It's icy water. And the octopuses that I work with are the giant Pacific octopus. So their mantle doesn't hold a little spit of water. It holds like a half gallon of water. And I have had them, I have even had an octopus that I kind of knew was inclined to squirt me. And so I had this tank that had doors that came up and stayed at like a 50 or 60 degree angle above the, they were hinged on one side of the top of the tank, and they came up and made a little vertical barrier. And so I knew this, I was giving a tour. I knew this octopus kind of liked to squirt me. I brought the group in and I very deliberately stood behind that barrier. And the octopus nevertheless managed to arch the water up over that barrier and hit me directly in the face. I was the only person she squirted that day. And so they're very onto it. So yeah, great question. What do they do when they're interacting with each other and they're trying to discourage one another? And, you know, I imagine when two of them are very close, they might use just a water squirt, but it's not going to have a big effect, right? It kind of blows the fish away at least a little bit. But for an octopus, the other octopus is anchored to the bottom, just like they are. They're in the water already. If you're underwater and somebody takes a turkey baster and squirts you in the face with water, doesn't matter. You're underwater, right? Who cares?
Right.
So instead, they will drop down into their den and they gather up this big bolus of silt and shells. And then they come up to the surface and they actually tuck their siphon from the back between their rear leg pair and face it forward where it's pointed at all this debris that they're holding under their web. And then they rear up just a little bit, not a lot, just a little bit. They rear up a little bit and they exhale really hard and they blast the water at all that stuff stuff they're holding in their arms right as they release it. And it shoots out towards whatever they've aimed it at. And they're aiming it at each other. So they're basically throwing these silk clouds and shell projectiles right at each other. And it was really fascinating to think about this. Of course, I was working on this with Peter. And one of my students was the first one to notice it. She brought me this little video clip. I had them scoring the video for me. And she brought me this little video clip and she said, this looks like they're, is this guy doing this on purpose? And this octopus had picked up a bunch of shells, climbed up on top of, it looks like a rock, but it's not. It's the central artifact around which Octopolis is built. Climbed up on top of this little rock and pushed the shells over the edge where they fell directly down onto the head of another octopus. And I looked at this and it just looked so deliberate, but who's to say? So yeah. I sent it to Peter and I said, hey, Peter, what do you think of this? You know, is this deliberate? And Peter was like, I don't know. How would you tell? And we didn't talk about it again for some years. And then Peter had been intrigued by it, though, and he started collecting instances. And he gave a brief talk once where he showed some of these and he said, I just don't know how we could ever decide whether this is deliberate or not. And so there it sat for several years. But I had sent him an answer. I'd said, look, what if we did any of these five things? And he eventually came back to me. And by then he had documented over 100 of these cases of octopuses throwing things at one another. And we had already done some other work to show how they turn dark before they become a little more aggressive, or they're very pale when they're about to retreat, or they're trying to skirt around a skirmish of any kind. And so we had a little more tools in our belt. And yeah, we did some analysis of this, and it does appear to be deliberate. They do appear to be aiming, but throw aiming, targeting something, right? It's sort of a behavior, but it's really an intention. I intend to hit you. You can aim and miss.
Yes.
You hit someone by accident. If you have a sibling, you know all about this.
Yes.
Right? And so this question of intention became really one of these things where we didn't want to answer it by looking at the number of times that these throws hit another animal.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to answer it using other correlated behaviors, like do they turn dark beforehand? Did they adjust their aim in any way? You know, and things like that. And so that's what we ended up analyzing.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's so interesting. You bring up this change in color that can be an indicator of the state of mind or intention or emotion, if I may say, of these wonderful creatures. And, you know, I think one of the things that strikes so many people as mysterious about octopuses and other cephalopods is that they can change color. And I don't know if this is the same way that chameleons change color or if it's a different mechanism. Can you take a little bit of the mystery, maybe not all of it, out for us?
Yeah. Octopus skin is this amazingly complex organ. And, you know, chameleons, when they change color, it almost feels like a blush, you know, it gradually moves up. And I was at an animal behavior talk and I watched a talk by a researcher who was looking at chameleons changing color. And I was very impressed momentarily with the speed of it because I thought it had been quite slow. And then I asked him in the videos that he showed. And then afterwards I said, are these videos at normal speed or have you sped them up? And he was like, oh, no, it's vastly sped up. You can barely see it with the eye. But for an octopus, the chameleons are slowpoke. An octopus changes color as fast as you can snap your fingers in literally the blink of an eye. The octopus skin color changes are controlled by muscles and nerves in the skin, and they are active motion. And so there's this display that's called the passing cloud display, which can start around the eyes as like a dark band, and then the darkness will move in a wave down the arms of the octopus. And this happens very quickly, like a cloud moving at a good brisk clip across the sun. And that's why it's called the passing cloud display. And so they're changing very quickly. It's very rapid from dark to light, but also different elements coming and going. Bands appear or disappear. Wrinkles and folds in the skin can appear. So it's all part of their postural and body pattern display.
And are they communicating information when they're changing all of those colors?
They seem to be. People have known for a while that cuttlefish and squid will communicate to rivals and to mates with body pattern displays. But octopuses were always considered so solitary, and the importance of the body pattern displays in camouflage was so great that no one ever really talked very much about the possibility even that octopus body pattern displays would be octopus to octopus signals. Mm-hmm. And then when we started recording all the video at Octopolis, you know, I remember the first interaction that I saw at Octopolis was an octopus coming from sort of the back of the screen in the distance towards one that was in a den near the camera. And then right next to it was another octopus in another den near the camera. So there's three octopuses on screen. In this video, I'm looking at this video from the perspective of an Alaskan researcher who's hardly ever seen even one octopus underwater. You know, I did most of my work on the beach at low tide with the octopuses out of the water. And so this was very exciting to me. But the rear octopus comes forward, and as it approaches the forward octopus, the rear octopus gets darker and darker and darker and stands up taller and taller and taller. And the forward octopus sees it coming and hunkers down, but also turns very pale. And then this approaching octopus wrestles with the one in the den, pulls it out of the den eventually. And then the approaching octopus envelops it in its web. And there's this little fight. And then the octopus that had been in the den kind of gets away. And as it gets away, you can see it jet away and it's pale. It's completely white. And then the octopus that had been the approaching octopus settles down into the den, turns very dark, and reaches to that third octopus I mentioned in the neighboring den. Now, you would think the third octopus would turn very pale,
right,
and that another fight was going to happen. But no, the third octopus turns really, really dark and reaches back. The third octopus is not interested in fleeing. It's going to stand its ground. And so I looked at that. I said, they're signaling to one another. That's crazy. No one's ever heard of octopuses signaling to one another. And so that then became, you know, the thing I wanted to do as I joined this team looking at these octopuses in Australia was, can we figure this signaling thing out a little bit? And we're definitely still working on it. There's behaviors that we see routinely that are still a bit of a mystery. But this dark approach, I'm going to mess with you. This pale, please don't mess with me, I'm going to leave. And this dark to dark, I'm standing my ground, I'm not going anywhere. How do you feel about that? That seems to be robust. And that's kind of what we've published about that.
Yes, yes. And, you know, so, and the wonderful thing is when you find an organism that keeps giving you new questions. And, you know, I think that, you know, I mentioned sort of at the beginning, this gravitational pull, this mysterious quality that we seem to ascribe to octopuses. And some people have even called octopuses aliens. And, you know, we know now that they can edit their RNA while protecting their DNA. And listeners may not necessarily know exactly what that means, but it's kind of huge. And so why are they so special in all of these different ways? What do you think it makes them so special?
I don't think it's any one thing. Octopuses kind of seem special to us just to start with because their bodies don't look familiar, but they're looking at us with eyes that we think we can identify with. That's a lot of that's in us, right? You've got these eight arms, which kind of are reminiscent of worms or worse yet, snakes. And then they've all got suction cups on them. What's that all about? They're going to grab hold of me and never let go. But when I look in their eyes, I feel like they're my buddy. They're my puppy dog, you know? And it doesn't hurt that their pupils are little dog bone shaped horizontal slits, right? You know, they're very expressive. They raise their head when they're interested in you and they look alert. They hunker down when they're a little threatened and their skin is changing all the time. Is that red? Does that mean they're angry? You know, you can just read so much into their body that you are immediately intrigued with them, but also slightly trepidatious. And so that, I think, raises all these really interesting questions of how much of that is real and how much of that is just the human putting its own perspective on top of the animal, right?
Sure.
And then also, you look at this crazy physiology where their nervous systems are built of nerve cells that are remarkably like our nerve cells. They're not myelinated, so they're not exactly like them. They're slower, actually. But then the neural anatomy, the brain only has about a third of the neurons in the body, and all the rest of the neurons are out distributed out in the body. Yeah. And that proportion for humans would be about 95% in the brain, 5% in the rest of the body. So it's radically different. Is that important? Does it matter? How different is that? Why is it so wild? So you immediately think about all these different questions. And then in terms of that nervous function, how do their nerve cells work? They're non-myelinated nerve cells, so they're slower. But then one of the things the RNA editing has to do with is different species edit their RNA differently so that the nerve cells can work as best as possible, even as the water gets colder. So we tend to think of octopuses as tropical animals, coral reef specialists. If you don't think about it very hard, that probably sounds familiar. But octopuses also live in cold water. They live in basically from the tropics to the poles, to the deep seas, to the intertidal. You're going to find octopuses. And so some species have to deal with a very different temperature and how to get the nerve function to stay fast enough without myelination. And it turns out that a lot of this RNA editing is going on in the genes that are active in the nervous system.
Wow.
Right. Wow. And so it has to do with neural function, which is fascinating. And the other thing that's fascinating about that, of course, is the octopuses don't have a particularly high diversity of genetics, as I understand it, gene types in this area of nervous regulation, but they edit their DNA. So their RNA is immensely diverse. Yeah. Whereas in the so-called smart vertebrates, you know, like humans, we have immensely diverse genotypes.
Yes.
In the same areas, right? Or the same functional areas. So that in order to be smart, we both need this diversity of alternatives in the nervous system, its genetic regulation, but we get at it by very different ways.
Yeah.
We maintain a much larger DNA. They build a much larger RNA.
Yeah. Well, and
which is fascinating.
It is. And, you know, we can obviously we can think about that from, you know, adapting to different environments. And then that for me just brings up the question, does that mean that octopuses might have an advantage, we hope, for changing ocean temperatures? Or are there other physiological limits that they're going to hit as we get changes continuing to happen in our oceans?
Yeah. And of course, the scenarios I've painted have been of octopuses that are modifying their genetic programming, well, their RNA, the expression of their genetic programming. They're modifying that to allow them to maintain good nervous function as the seas get colder.
Right.
And it's another question, what happens if you go in the other direction? In terms of their physiology, I think it's a wonderful question, whether that flexibility of RNA editing that they have will allow them physiologically to cope better as the oceans warm. But the warming oceans present, I think, a different problem to octopuses. Generally speaking, when the surface of the oceans are cold, it's because of upwelling. It's mixing, right? And that upwelling brings nutrients to the surface, and the nutrients cause plankton blooms and allow life to flourish, and food is abundant, and everyone's happy. And all the predators, the fish, all the various kinds of predators, they're feeding on their preferred hyperabundant prey. And octopuses are feeding on crab nopuli and, you know, little planktonic clams in the plankton and that kind of stuff. Conversely, as the ocean's surfaces warm up, warm water floats, cold water sinks. And so that means there's not mixing going on, which means there's not nutrients coming up from the bottom, which means you don't have the nutrients to support this high productivity of the oceans. And when you have that lower productivity, the octopuses have a harder time getting food. They grow more slowly. They stay small longer, and their predators are more hungry, and they don't have alternative food to eat. So the smaller, slower growing octopuses get eaten. And so I think what you have is a scenario in which cold water with mixing and high productivity supports high octopus recruitment. Warm water with lower productivity and greater predation threat interferes with high octopus recruitment. And so, you know, we've seen this in some of our data from Alaska and from Puget Sound, that following warm winters, in which I imagine the octopuses are at greater risk and are slower growing, you get decreased octopus abundance. And it worries me that that's a pattern for one species. At the south of England, warmer waters may actually mean that the Mediterranean octopus can move north. And so its range might be expanding northward. But it does worry me that as the climate warms up, more and more octopus species will enter that zone of trouble from global climate change than will be in this realm of range expansion. option from global climate change. We don't know yet, but it seems plausible.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I want to be mindful of your time, and there's so much to unpack in this marvelous book, Many Things Under a Rock. No, I don't want to leave any stone unturned.
Thank you for that.
Yeah. Octopuses are the stuff of myths and legends. And so can you tell me a little bit, because your book is peppered very liberally with a lot of cultural information, as well as information about the science and the process and the octopuses themselves. How did you come to give your book the title, Many Things Under a Rock? Does it have a special meaning?
I was really intrigued, and have been and remain really intrigued by the way octopus science blends into octopus myth and eventually into monster stories. But the title itself, as I mentioned, I was working with a lot of Alaska Native communities as I began this work. And that led me to just an interest out of politeness, if not more, in learning the Alaska Native language words for octopus. And I was fascinated when I learned the Eyak word for octopus. Eyak were the native peoples that lived and occupied the lands where the village of Cordova is located right now. And that's where I was living. And the Eyak word for octopus is Salaksguk. It's one of those words that is assembled from other words that have meaning. And so literally it means a bunch of things or a collection of things under a rock, many things under a rock. And so I thought that was just such an evocative image. And then given how much we were finding under rocks and how many different diverse and fascinating topics I was led to by studying octopuses, everything from parasites on crabs to how the DNA works to what can we learn about an animal's dream life? You know, it didn't matter where I turned. There was always a new thing to look at under the rocks. And so I thought it was a great image for the title of the book.
It evokes that image, and it captures the diversity of things that you are still looking at and that you have found some answers to. And I want to close with one last question. Do you have a particularly special or memorable experience with an octopus that stands out for you among all the many, many hours that you have worked with these marvelous creatures?
Yeah, there are several, of course, and we've already talked about one or two of them here. The first time I looked at a video from Octopolis is particularly memorable. There was an incident in Morea following an octopus that went on a foraging trip with me that was great fun. But, you know, one that was particularly memorable was in an aquarium, actually, with an octopus that we kept for a little while that was named Obi. And Obi was a medium-sized day octopus, very active, but also just a touch nervous. And so I put Mr. Potato Head, you know, the kid's toy. That's a fun toy for octopuses. They pull all the little parts out and so on. But also, Mr. Potato Head is made with a little hatch in his drawers, if you will. And, you know, as a toy, you can store his spare parts in there. But as an octopus toy, you can put a food item in there. And so I put a little food item in Mr. Potato Head's drawers, and I dropped him down into the bottom of the aquarium. And Obi was captivated, very interested in Mr. Potato Head, reached out and touched him. But the thing is, a potato head is much lighter underwater than a clam or a crab. And so the potato head, as soon as Obi touched it, the suckers sort of automatically adhere. And Mr. Potato Head then came marching confidently towards Obi, seemingly of its own volition, right? With his big eyes. And Obi was just freaked out and just jumped back in surprise. And then gradually she worked up the courage again to reach out and touch Mr. Potato Head again. But the same thing happened. Mr. Potato Head then starts marching towards Obi, and Obi was just startled and reached back. And so the third time, Obi had just had it with this Mr. Potato Head. It was clearly interesting, but only approached when Obi was curious. So Obi reared back and she turned all dark, and she put these brilliant, like, orange color along the rims of her suckers, and she lifted up her forward two arms, and she had her lower arms, and so she made this like giant octopus arm mouth aim at Mr. Potato Head, and was just as large as Mr. Potato Head. Whole thing, you know, it just looked awesome, but it was hysterically funny, and it also made me think, you know, those arms are really the size of her mouth. Like, her mouth is this little tiny thing, you don't even hardly see an octopus octopus's mouth. But the arms are these prehensile, extended, sucker-studded lips. And when the octopus spreads their arm, they're basically opening their mouth, and that's their gape size. And so it was this interesting, charming, hysterically funny moment that also made me think about octopuses in a whole new way.
Wow. That's such a vivid description. And if you'll indulge me, I'll just share my one brief connection with an octopus.
Oh, please do.
I was in the Bahamas. I was about 11 years old, and we used to go to Man O' War Key. It's a small little island. And I had been running on the pier deck or whatever out to the bay, and a giant piece of splinter wood went into my foot, like deep.
Oh.
Yes. And I was determined that I didn't need anyone's assistance to get this out. If I just soaked it long enough in the water, I would be fine. It would just magically, come out. Punchline, that is not true. But what I remember, and no one could coax me away from the octopus that was there where I dangled my foot.
Oh,
and
wow.
I felt like I had this friend keeping me company while I was sitting. I mean, I sat there for hours, and this octopus was just there. It didn't do anything. I don't know what it was doing, but I remember being fascinated with it. And I was convinced as long as the octopus was there, I was going to be fine. And that my foot.
That's how I feel.
There you go. And so I think on that note, I want to thank you so much. And I loved Many Things Under a Rock, and I hope listeners go out and buy that book. It's really spectacular.
Well, thank you. Thank
thanks
you.
I'm glad for, you're good. Thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure.
One of the things that came up in the podcast was the octopus nurseries. They've always been a mystery to scientists, and just this past week, we finally have an answer. In the deep waters off the coast of California is an octopus nursery with over 6,000 pearly octopuses. The answer to why this nursery is located here only deepens my respect for the incredible intelligence octopuses possess. What's the answer? It seems they somehow have figured out that in these deep, cold waters, there's a little bit of warmth to be found. The baby octopus garden sits on top of extinct volcanic vents, and these vents give off a little extra heat. Without this extra warmth, it would take about 4 years for these octopus babies to mature. Instead, in a mere 2 years, they're ready to rock and roll in the ocean. That's all for this week's podcast, but tune in next time when I talk to author Danielle Claude, and we will unpack the life of koalas. If you're digging the show, subscribe and share it so others can enjoy it too. You can follow the show on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also check out the show notes at Wild Connection, the podcast, hosted by Podbean, or on my website, jennifervertelin.com. Thanks for listening.